It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, in today for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, the mayor of La Crosse, Tim Cabot, joins us. He was in Washington this week, along with other mayors from the Mississippi River area, to discuss disaster prevention measures and other issues facing their river communities.
But first, the history of religion and how religion has shaped modern society is well documented. But what about the history of those who have challenged religion?
Our next guest says atheists helped to shape the modern world. He's trying to fill the void on information with his latest book. It's called Imagine There's No Heaven, How Atheism Helped Create the Modern World. Mitchell Stevens joins us. He's a historian and professor of journalism at New York University. Mitch, welcome back to Central Time.
It's nice to be back with you.
On a broadly speaking level, do you think atheists throughout history and their contributions have been ignored or overlooked?
I certainly think they've been ignored, in part because history was written by the dominant people in a culture, and the dominant people in most cultures in human history have been religious. But I think the role of atheism has been quite important in the development of science and development of learning, and also in the development of human rights and liberty.
Is there something fundamentally different about the contributions atheists or non-believers have made to the great religious traditions of the world?
Well, there's no doubt that the great religious traditions have contributed a lot, but there are tens of thousands of books detailing that, and I thought that the contributions of those who've challenged religion, of non-believers, should be recognized. And I think mostly it comes down to two things. Atheists have been very good at saying we need to focus on this earth, on this universe, on the natural world, not the supernatural world. And atheists have also been very good at saying we need to focus on this life, not some imagined afterlife or other life. And these two moves have been tremendously fertile in human history.
And you also make the case that whereas a religious tradition, the prime motivation is to accept the religious authority, whatever form that might take, atheism comes from and enhances an idea of challenging authority and trying to find something new.
Well, of being open to observation and experiment, which Newton, shortly before he died, said are the two best ways of understanding anything. And religion always pushes, as you put it, authority. The idea that what is written in some book or what is said by some religious leader can't be challenged. And that's not a good way, we've learned, of pushing human knowledge forward.
I tend to think of atheism, non-belief in a particular religion, as a fairly modern thing, but you trace it pretty far back.
Yeah, well, we know that religion is very old. It's hard to find any society in human history that doesn't have some sort of belief in some sort of other world. But I think what I learned in investigating this history is that challenges to religion are also very old. They're not always expressed out loud. They're not always recorded. If they are written down, often those books somehow don't manage to survive. But when you can look, either in anthropological literature or in attacks on atheists sometimes give us clues, you can see that it's been around for a long time. I mean, there's a poem that seems to be somewhat anti-religion that goes back 4,000 years in Egypt. There's evidence of non-believers, people who ask the question I love, how can that be when told that there is existence after death, for example? That's in the anthropological literature. So that's in preliterate societies.
When we think of ancient Greece, I think back of the mythology books I read as a kid, Zeus and Hera and Athena and all of them. But you also point out that there was a significant atheist community that made a lot of contributions to the development of thought in ancient Greece.
Well, there were enough atheists in Greece during perhaps its golden age, one of the great ages of learning in human history, that Plato was upset by them. He thought there were too many. He thought he was dealing with a kind of hotbed of atheism in Athens, and they have a way of turning up where Greece's advances are also turning up. For example, the scientist and philosopher Anaxagoras, who actually didn't just assume that the sun is something pulled around by a god on a chariot, but went and investigated a meteorite and concluded that the sun is a red-hot mass of metal which puts brightness into the moon, or the historian Thucydides, who may have been a student of Anaxagoras, who, when he gave his history, unlike his predecessors, the Greek historian Herodotus, didn't tell stories of men riding dolphins and of curses coming true. He decided to look for what he called the clear truth of what happened. He didn't, when he talked about the plague in Athens, he didn't talk about odd prophecies that may somehow seem to have affected it. He talked about symptoms and how it spread. And so it was an extraordinary period in human history, and a period in which atheists were very important.
Jumping ahead rather a lot, the Enlightenment period in France was arguably the dawn of modern atheism, or what we'd think of it. How dangerous was it initially in that period to express atheistic beliefs?
Well, perhaps the greatest of the French thinkers, and perhaps the greatest of the French atheists, was Denis Diderot. And Diderot wrote his books where he challenged religion, just like he wrote his books where he challenged monarchy, under pseudonyms. He did not publish them under his own name, but people had an idea what was going on. And for the one book where he really came out as a non-believer in religion, the police came and got him, and he ended up spending a month in a dungeon and a couple of months in a prison in France. So it was very dangerous to do. But nevertheless, it was being done, and there was a salon in Paris that Diderot attended twice a week for decades, run by his buddy Baron de Holbach, which was filled with non-believers. At one point, Baron de Holbach decides to count how many atheists are sitting around the table, and according to Diderot, he counted 15 with three more who hadn't decided yet. And these were some of the great thinkers in France and in the world who stopped by when they were in Paris.
One of the concerns people express about atheism is that if you run a society without God, without religion, you lose your moral framework. Things will go nuts. And soon after Diderot, you had the French Revolution, and there was the terror, and things really did seem to go bad. How do we square that? Was it because of atheism that we saw the terror and on ahead to atheist communism in the last century?
Well, there's no doubt that atheism has been associated with a couple of very bad moments in human history. The terror, when the guillotine was moving rapidly, continued during the period when atheists, there's a brief period of a few months, when atheists took control of the French Revolution. So it's an inglorious period in this history. When Marx, who was an atheist, and Lenin and then his followers, Lenin and Stalin, took control of the Soviet Union, there also was a tremendous amount of killing. So these were bad times. I think what atheists had to work out was that you don't just substitute another kind of religion for the religion you've gotten rid of. And I think the problem during the French Revolution was in part that they kind of made a religion out of non-religion. And certainly I think that was one of the problems with Soviet communism, that it started to acquire all the attributes of a religion, with a kind of utopian future, a kind of heaven, with a cause that it was worth dying for and worth killing for. And I think it's taken much of the 20th century, but I think humankind is starting to learn that it's not enough to get rid of some of these some of the religions, which have also caused enough killing in the world. But we also have to make sure we don't substitute kinds of secular religions for them.
We're talking to historian Mitchell Stevens about his new book, Imagine There's No Heaven: How Atheism Helped Create the Modern World. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We're continuing our discussion on how the contributions of atheists throughout history may have helped create the modern world, and we'd like to hear from you on this too. What do you think about atheism? Has it been good or bad for the modern world, and why? And how important do you think the role of atheism has been for society? You can call in at 800-642-1234 or send us an email, talk@WPR.org.
We'll go right to our callers now. We've got Bill on the line in Greendale. Bill, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, great show. I just wanted to say I'm a believer. You know, I think that there is a God of love that I experience inside and I see around me, but I have no problem with people who say there isn't a God. You know, and this gentleman here, he's informative. He also believes in humanity and science, too, which I think is important. So I just wanted to say that.
Bill, thanks a lot for that call. And Mitch, we have something that we wouldn't have seen 500 years ago, atheists and believers existing and getting along more or less okay, if sometimes argumentative, in the same society.
No, that's a wonderful thing, and I really appreciate what your caller said. You know, I first started thinking about writing this book a couple of decades ago before there was a burst of books on atheism, and I was frankly nervous whether these ideas would really be accepted, whether you could appear on radio saying these sorts of things or appear on TV, whether, you know, whether people would react angrily. And I think things have changed in the world, and I think they've changed in some very nice ways. Not everywhere, not among everybody, but among a lot of people.
There has been what's been accused of being a combative strain of new atheism, people have called it, people aggressively challenging, though still on an intellectual level, Christianity and other religions. Do you see things heating up in that way, or is it just nothing compared to most of human history?
Well, human history, you know, as you're saying, always works with a certain amount of conflict, and I guess you need people who are willing to take angry positions and really fight for their rights. And some of the, you know, some of the advances in religion and some of the advances in the struggle to ease the hold of religion have required, I think, people like that. But I think you know, the more important thing goes on in all of us. I mean, I can see religion fading in certain ways. I think, you know, it's hard to see because we hear the people who are loudest about religion around the world and in the United States, and sometimes who seem most intolerant, and maybe we hear the loudest atheists too. But I think religion is in many ways a weaker force. I don't think everybody's becoming atheists. Obviously, the number is much lower. But I think the demands of religion, Americans are much less likely to tell pollsters today that their religion is the only acceptable one. And that's a significant change.
We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Greg on the line in Milwaukee. Greg, hi, you're on the air.
Good evening. Hi, good evening. I believe that I'm an atheist myself. I don't cut people down for believing in religion because I don't cut people down for saying 2 + 2 = 5 either. I might tell them their mistakes. I can't believe in the Immaculate Conception. I believe Mary had sex. I look at I'm a scientist. I look at all the creations. I look at Galileo. He was arrested. I look at Michelangelo put in prison or house arrested, and every time a scientist who really thinks, he can't believe in things because he's told things by his parents. He has to be able to prove things to himself. And if you can't find any proof for anything in the Bible, and then you hear people saying, "Oh, it's everything's predicted in the Bible," but it's not. It's so ambiguous. I can't see anyone reading the same book for their whole lifetime over and over again. It's foolhardy.
Greg, thanks for the call. And Mitch, religion and science, and this is a big part of your book. Let's look at a figure like Isaac Newton, a religious person, considered himself very religious, finding out the rules that God designed the universe by was, I'm paraphrasing incredibly there. Do they have to be incompatible, science and religion?
Well, I mean, Newton is a fascinating example, and in some ways it doesn't really support Greg's point, because as you're saying, Newton was a religious man. And he spent a lot of time trying to think through religion. But I think it's also really significant for my argument to the importance of atheism in creating the modern world that in Isaac Newton's great book, maybe one of the greatest books
works of reason ever written, Principia Mathematica, in the first edition of that book, he never mentions God. So he worked out a whole theory of how the universe works. He taught us as much about the universe as anyone ever did, and he did it leaving God out. And in some ways, you almost have to, because if God is the one that's pushing all the planets around and moving everything and keeping everything in order, then what's to figure out? I mean, Newton subtracted that idea, and I think that was, and that's how I think we learned.
And you make the point in the book that as we understood more things scientifically or with natural explanations, each time that happened, it created less room for religion to do the explaining.
Yes, that's certainly true. And, maybe the other great science book in human history is Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species. And one of the things I learned looking at this, that Darwin, who had been quite a religious man, didn't lose his religion because he came up with this theory of evolution by natural selection. He lost his religion before that, and after having lost it and becoming pretty much a person without religion, he was able to think up his theory. And I think, again, that's crucial. If he had, if he was still trying to figure out God's role in the whole thing, if he was still taking the Bible as authority, I don't think he would have worked out his magnificent theory.
We'll go back to our phones now. We've got Bree on the line in Madison. Bree, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I would just like to say great show. And I just had a comment regarding the whole idea of atheism and maybe viewing it as a religion itself, but replacing the God figure with the self. And maybe that is why there's been such an increase, because the faith is in human knowledge and the development of the self. And I'd like to hear feedback regarding that. But, thank you for having me.
Bree, thanks for the call. Mitch, atheism is a religion replacing God with ourselves, she's saying.
Well, I think we have to acknowledge that there is something humble about the religious attitude. I mean, one of the positive things about religion is this ability to humble yourself before a larger force. But I haven't really seen any evidence that atheists are particularly self-involved. And one of the fun things about my book was really discovering all these important characters who have been forgotten. And many of them end up being people who quite the opposite of being selfish and self-involved, really struggled for human rights. Perhaps my favorite is a woman named Ernestine Rose, a rabbi's daughter born in Poland, who broke with her father when she started questioning religion. He said a young girl shouldn't do that, and ended up making her way to London and eventually to New York, where she became one of the most prominent crusaders against slavery, sharing stage with Frederick Douglass often. For women's rights, she often traveled with Susan B. Anthony, and Anthony handled the business arrangements. Ernestine Rose gave the speeches, and also speaking out constantly for atheism and against what she called mental slavery or religion.
Thanks a lot for the call, Bree. We just have a couple minutes left, and I'm going to drop kind of a huge question, Mitch. We touched on this a bit earlier. Atheism, you've made the case, helped a lot with scientific progress, but can it replace the moral component of a religion? Can there be a moral system without a God imposing it on us?
Well, I think we're at a point in human history where many of us are starting to realize that there is no external, simple, clear moral system that was written down in a book a few thousand years ago. And I think this is a wonderful point in human history, because we're having to work this stuff out ourselves. And in many ways, I think we're beginning, and we're doing this. I mean, we talked before about how some of the early atheist movements didn't lead to such happy conclusions during the French Revolution and with Karl Marx's ideas. But I think we're doing much better now. And I think most of us, even the religion the religious among us are doing a pretty good job of working out our own moral systems. I'm not sure we need some deity up in the heavens or basically some old holy book talking about it in thousand-year-old terms where women are meant to serve man, where homosexuality is automatically immoral and love between people of the same sex is deserving of killing and punishment. I don't think we need that to work at our moral system. I think we're doing a pretty good job, obviously not a perfect job, of beginning to work that out ourselves.
Mitch, thanks for joining us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Mitchell Stevens, historian and professor of journalism at New York University. He was talking about his new book, Imagine There's No Heaven, How Atheism Helped Create the Modern World.
Coming up next, mayors from towns along the Mississippi River met with lawmakers in Washington this week to push for more disaster prevention measures. And we'll hear from the mayor of La Crosse. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferrat. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
It's Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrat. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it is Food Friday. We're going to get some delicious lab-tested advice on great gluten-free cooking.
But first, mayors from cities and towns along the Mississippi River met with lawmakers in Washington this week to try to focus attention on some of the challenges that are specific to the Mississippi River.
A big push in that meeting was securing disaster prevention funding for things like flooding, droughts, and even hurricanes. While the federal government provides disaster relief, the mayors say a more efficient approach would be to spend money on prevention.
La Crosse Mayor Tim Cabot was at the meeting in Washington, and he joins us now. Mayor, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I want to start out with a little bit of background on the Mississippi River Cities and Towns Initiative. What is it exactly, and what are you trying to accomplish?
Well, it's really a new organization. We've been together here for a little over 2 years, and it was started by mayors. It was really an initiative that started at the kind of the grassroots level. There's a little over 120 cities and towns up and down the Mississippi from the headwaters to the Gulf, and there was a vision here of looking at the Mississippi River as one system. Even though the upper Mississippi River and the challenges that we face might be a little bit different than the lower Mississippi River, it's still, in the end, one system. And the mayors here at the local level felt strongly that we need to have better partnerships and a better voice with the federal government and ultimately also the state governments to deal with the variety of programs and regulations and funding that would impact the Mississippi River.
Now, when a lot of people who might not live near the Mississippi may not understand the role that federal and state governments play in regulating commerce and, you know, zoning regulations and all of that. So give us a taste of some of the problems and issues that you're trying to address.
Well, we're really, for this year, we're focused on several real core areas. I mean, what I had just mentioned, trying to work with our policymakers and elected officials and agencies to treat the river as one unified system. I think that in and of itself is very important. As a part of our efforts about a year ago, at the federal level through Congress and through the Senate, we formed the Mississippi River Caucus, which is a bicameral and bipartisan group. I think it includes now over 25 members of either the House or Senate. To, again, focus policy and programs on ways to use our limited funding and those types of efforts just much more efficiently. We're also focused on working with the Farm Bill that was signed to establish a National Drought Council that, again, could work through the state and local levels to be better prepared for the droughts and some of the weather extremes that we're seeing. We want to work together with, you know, the multiple federal agencies to deal with the invasive species that are plaguing the Mississippi River Basin. And then there's a number of other areas looking at pre-disaster mitigation for some of the flood issues that we face up and down the river. There's, you know, the Army Corps has a civil works budget of a little over $5 billion in how to best spend on the infrastructure, because if you look at our lock and dam system, in essence, it's about 80 years old and hasn't really seen any significant upgrades up and down the river. And then there's also other areas, again, looking at working with our federal agencies to deal with the dead zone that's in the Gulf and just all the things that we can do, clean water. So there's a number of initiatives. Again, it impacts people. And even though folks might not live right close to the Mississippi River is the drainage basin for about 37 states. So I would say that just about anywhere that you live in the United States has an impact to the Mississippi River.
You know, early on in the interview, you talked about that idea of treating the Mississippi River as a system. And, you know, I think maybe from our perspective, that might sound like a logical thing to do. But having been around the Mississippi for a long time and knowing some of the politics there, I know that's not the case. I mean, people tend to focus on kind of the river that's in front of them. In your estimation, how important a step is this?
Well, I think it's a very critical and needed step, and that's been one of the, I guess, one of the things that I have enjoyed in getting to meet the other mayors, and I think that hopefully left an impression with our federal meetings with elected officials and the agencies as well, the fact that you have this very diverse group of mayors from big cities, you know, from the St. Louis and Memphis, Tennessee, and those size cities all the way down to the smaller towns, the fact that we're able to come together and you know, at times be able to put aside some of the details with the thought of how do we, you know, work on the overall river system. And we know that an ecologically healthy river is going to be an economically, you know, driving system. That I think is really important, and that was a big message that we took to Washington, and again, in working with all those federal agencies to develop those partnerships.
So when you went to Washington, what were you asking for? Were you just sort of introducing lawmakers to this concept, or were you asking for something more specific beyond that?
Well, we did. It was really a combination of both. Again, we had opportunities to meet with our representatives that are already part of the Mississippi River Caucus. We did get a chance to reach out to House members and senators who are not a member of the Mississippi River Caucus, asking them to join. And then we did have some very, you know, specific priorities when we talked about supporting the pre-disaster mitigation program at that $400 million level. We really feel strongly that, you know, it's the old adage, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And if we can spend the funds, especially in a community like La Crosse, where we have three rivers, we have about 2,000 properties that are in the floodplain, if we can spend those pre-disaster mitigation dollars on floodproofing and removing properties out of the floodplain and doing the kinds of things in the front end, it's a much more cost-effective way to spend limited tax dollars than having to come after the fact, after there's been a catastrophe or a weather issue where you've got to clean up and deal with property damage. So we had, again, it was, I thought, real beneficial to be able to talk more broadly about this one river system, but then also very specifically about certain funds and certain programs.
So you've been to Washington. You've been working hard at trying to get the word out. What happens next?
Well, we'll continue. We continue our efforts. This is a group, again, I had mentioned we're still a relatively new group of mayors. We will have an annual meeting coming up here in a few months. I think it's in the fall in New Orleans to continue to highlight the fact that this is a single system. Some of the areas that we really focused on this time was to talk about the fact of the importance of the river restoration and those programs to bring back the health of the river and dealing with some of the innovative projects like we're doing up in this part of the Upper Miss, building islands and the drawdowns to improve water quality and the health of the wildlife, dealing with the invasive species. I mean, those efforts are long-term efforts, and we're going to continue to fight those fights each and every day because, you know, overall, that health of the river is critical to our economy. I mean, there's, you know, approximately 500 million tons of commodities that get shipped every year up and down the river, and we can't do that if the river is not healthy.
And one final question before we let you go. In terms of the health of the river now, is it in better shape than it was, say, 10 or 20 years ago? Or are we going slipping back in some areas?
No, I believe at least the reports and the information that we shared, you know, the health of the river is improving. And that's one of the areas that we're focused on funding, because there was a proposed cut to the monitoring of the river health and some of those indicators. And that's, you know, that's backwards, I guess, or taking a step back. We want to be able to keep the funding for the monitoring of the water quality and those other measures, because we have to be able to look at, you know, from a scientific standpoint, are we getting better and are things improving? And if they are, well, then let's keep that going. There was a proposal in Congress, I think, to cut about $1 million out of the monitoring program. And that's, you know, that's always a concern, because if you don't have the right data, then your programs aren't being as effective as they can be.
Well, Mayor, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
We've been speaking with Mayor Tim Kabat of La Crosse. He has joined other mayors from along the Mississippi River in Washington, D.C. this week to discuss the Mississippi River Cities and Towns Initiative. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's Friday. That means it's Food Friday. This week, we're learning about a big trend in food going gluten-free.
America's Test Kitchen listened to fan feedback and then spent a year in the kitchen testing recipes for a gluten-free cookbook. The Test Kitchen team recreated popular recipes without wheat, like old-fashioned birthday cake and fried chicken.
Here to give us advice about cooking without gluten is Jack Bishop, editorial director of America's Test Kitchen. Jack, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you guys.
I've had some gluten-free food, not gluten-free myself. A few of my coworkers here at WPR have made good things, but usually I think of gluten-free as a synonym for not very good. Is that a pretty common experience for people?
Yeah, I mean, I must say some of the early testing was about as bad as the testing gets in for us, and that it's very hard. You, in many ways, especially when you're baking, mm-hmm. you basically have to forget everything you know about baking and start over again.
Right. One assumption would be, well, if wheat flour is the problem, I'll just use non-wheat flour in my baking recipe. It's not that simple. What kind of discoveries did you make that complicated the issue a little bit?
Well, the thing about wheat flour that makes it so unique is that it's relatively high in protein, and it has two proteins that, when they get hydrated, form gluten. Gluten is what gives bread dough its elasticity, what gives a cake or cookie its structure. You can certainly use other flours that don't have proteins that form gluten, rice flour, sorghum flour, bean flours, but they also don't produce the same structure. So one of the first things we did was we made a lot of cookie recipes, and we were using different gluten-free flour blends. Rather than using a single flour, you generally can buy these blends that have multiple ingredients in them that are meant to replace wheat flour. And the first thing we noticed is that the cookies ran all over the cookie sheet, and basically we made one big burnt cookie.
Yum!
Yes, it wasn't very appetizing, and that's because the gluten that's in the wheat flour is what controls the spread of the cookies, so that the dough melts just enough so that you get 12 perfect cookies on a cookie sheet. And without those proteins, we were using a blend that was based mostly on rice flour, we were getting one big cookie that was basically running into the edges of the pan. And so we had to basically remake the recipe from the very beginning in order to figure out how to make a cookie that would spread just the right amount in the oven.
Well, after all this trial and error, you came up with, I think, what you're calling the America's Test Kitchen Gluten-Free Flour Mix. What ended up being like a good, versatile combo of flours that you can put together?
Yeah, so we really wanted one flour blend that would be sort of like all-purpose flour, that you could have one blend in your pantry that you could use to make a wide variety of cakes, cookies, breads, pancakes. And our blend has both white rice and brown rice flour, as well as tapioca and potato starch, and a little bit of non-fat milk powder. And that last ingredient is kind of the secret ingredient, because it really helps with the browning and helps with the flavor of the flour blends. You get some of the kind of sweet notes that are actually in wheat flour, and that when you make a gluten-free cake or gluten-free cookie, you end up missing because you don't have any of the wheat and any of the flavors that you're getting from the wheat.
Should we just skip those gluten-free flour mixes we can find at the specialty section of a store?
No, we tested about 10 different mixes, and the problem is they're all different from each other. You know, if you go to buy all-purpose flour, it's made with one ingredient, wheat flour, and no matter the brand, they're all basically the same. The problem with the gluten-free flour mixes is they're all made with different ingredients, and they all behave differently. We found two, King Arthur and Bob's Red Mill, that we liked quite a lot and that are pretty similar to the blend that we ended up developing in the test kitchen. The main reason that we developed our own blend was, one, it's about half the cost to buy the individual ingredients and mix them together, and it takes 30 seconds to make the blend. You literally measure five ingredients into a container, and you're done. And the other thing is we like to have total control, and we like our blend, and we like the ratio of ingredients. But we recognize that some people want to just pick up a box of flour at the supermarket, and so we recommend those two brands, King Arthur and Bob's Red Mill. And we tested every single recipe, not only with our own blend, but with those two store-bought blends.
One of my favorite things to make, especially in the morning, sometimes I'll even make it at night, is the pancake. What if I have gluten-free visitors? I want to make them pancakes. Am I out of luck, or can you make it work?
You can totally make it work. And really, that was the goal in all this testing, was not just to make something that was good enough for somebody who was on a gluten-free diet, but it would be good enough for everybody, because the reality is you're probably cooking for people who can eat gluten and people who can't. And you certainly don't want the rest of the people who can eat gluten complaining the entire time about the thing you made not being good enough. So pancakes actually really pretty simple. The main thing that we do differently is one of the challenges in any gluten-free baking is getting enough lift, enough rise. And so the baked goods can be very heavy and very dense and very rubbery. And so with pancakes, all we really need to do is to separate the eggs and to whip the whites until we get to stiff peaks, and then fold those egg whites into a batter that's basically gluten-free flour blend with buttermilk, a little bit of butter, a little sugar, baking powder, baking soda, similar ingredients. The key, though, was to get more rise by whipping those whites so that you ended up with light, fluffy buttermilk pancakes.
And on the cake theme, evidently our producer liked the look of the yellow layer cake. She put a bookmark in there, maybe for future reference. It looks like a fine cake. Similar things to what you did with the pancake there?
Cakes are really complicated. The main challenge with cakes is that gluten-free flours don't absorb fat very well. In particular, they don't absorb butter very well. Now, a pancake has very little butter in it, so it's not really much of a challenge. But there's a lot of butter in a layer cake. And we really had to cut out a lot of butter, because if we just used the normal amount of butter, the cake was really greasy and unappetizing. But then when we took the butter out, it didn't really taste all that rich and delicious. Hmm. And so we were having a lot more success with the chocolate cakes in the test kitchen, because chocolate is a much more stable fat than butter. Butter has a lot of water in it, which makes it relatively unstable. And so we said, well, could we put chocolate into our yellow cake? And we said, well, we could put white chocolate in. And so that's the secret ingredient. It not only has a small amount of butter for flavor, but then it has melted white chocolate that's added to the cake batter in order to give it richness and the kind of texture you expect from a yellow cake, but it's not greasy.
White chocolate instead of butter. How long did it take to come up with that?
There were a lot of cakes that were thrown in the garbage until we got to that idea. And as I say, it was one of those moments where we had six people in the test kitchen for a year, and they were having so much success with chocolate cupcakes, chocolate cakes, and brownies, and really not a lot of success with the yellow cakes or the yellow cupcakes, and said, well, is there a way to get chocolate in? And somebody we were sitting around said, well, yeah, we could just add white chocolate, and maybe it will perform the same way the dark chocolate does. And that obviously, you know, in a yellow cake, you can't have dark chocolate, because then you have a chocolate cake, not a yellow cake.
Well, when I think gluten-free, I mostly worry about baking, but wheat flour shows up in a lot of other places, too. You guys have a fried chicken recipe. How do you, you use the flour in the batter that makes the chicken crispy. What do you do to work around the gluten there?
There, it's a combination of our flour blend, and we use cornmeal. And the cornmeal really is a sort of secret ingredient there that replaces the flour. And, you know, you still use the seasoned seasoning, so you add cayenne, paprika, a little garlic powder, and you can still dunk in buttermilk because buttermilk makes the best fried chicken. The cornmeal is a real trick, and we have a little bit of cornstarch in there. And those end up replacing the wheat flour.
So is there anything you guys just banged your heads against walls and just couldn't come up with something that worked? Any failures?
We had a lot of really challenging recipes. In some cases, the simpler recipes, pie dough, biscuits, because there's not a whole lot in those. You know, there's four or five ingredients in those recipes. They were really, really challenging. I think we made 1,800 biscuits before we finally came up with a biscuit we really liked. But I got to say, in the end, we pretty much came up with an answer to most things that we tried to do. We came up with a solution.
All right, Jack, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Jack Bishop. He's editorial director of America's Test Kitchen. Their new book, The How Can It Be Gluten-Free Cookbook. We've got a recipe for the all-purpose gluten-free flour linked on the Central Time Facebook page, and we just tweeted that as well, @CentralTimeWPR. You can check it out there.